Certainly, the color break I spotted in Grand Army Plaza was like that. A wayward splatter of paint on a monochromatic ground, an extravagance I might not have noticed if not for the scrupulous precinct of order, of petal, of blossom, of plant, in which it happened to detonate. Etymologically, the word extravagant means to wander off a path or cross a line. Orderly lines, of course, being Apollo's special domain. In this may lie a clue to the abiding power of the tulip, as well as, perhaps, to the nature of beauty. The tulip is a flower that draws some of the most exquisite lines in nature, and then, in spasms of extravagance, blithely oversteps them. On the same principle, syncopation enlivens a regular 4-4 measure of music, enjambment the stately line of iambic pentameter. So here is a third constituent of beauty to add to the desiderata offered to us by the flower. First came contrast, then pattern or form, and finally, variation. The pleasure we take in the breaking of a too predictable pattern may account for the allure of the broken tulip, as well as the Rembrandt and the parrot, a type of tulip that explodes the tailored flower into the exuberant frills of a party dress. Then, of course, there is the black tulip, the gothic femme fatale in the masculine world of tulips. In The Queen of Night, the mysteriously depthless hue plays against the sunny lucidity of her form. Our eyes and ears quickly tire of any strict Apollonian order that isn't shadowed by some hint, some threat of trespass or waywardness. By the same token, the most breathtaking rose or peony is the one in which the tumbling profusion of its petals is held in check by some kind of form or frame. The slightest suggestion of symmetry, the form of a globe or teacup, say, keeps the bloom from going slack. The Greeks believed that true beauty, as opposed to mere prettiness, was the offspring of these two opposing tendencies, which they personified in Apollo and Dionysus, their two gods of art. Great art is born when Apollonian form and Dionysian ecstasy are held in balance, when our dreams of order and abandon come together. One tendency, uninformed by the other, can bring forth only coldness or chaos, the stiffness of a triumph tulip, the slackness of a wild rose. So though we can classify any particular flower as Apollonian or Dionysian, or male or female, the most beautiful flowers, like Semper Augustus or Queen of Night, are the ones that also partake of their opposing element. The Greeks' myth of beauty, the most persuasive I know of, takes us most of, but not all, the way back to beauty's origins in the commingling of tendencies found in the human brain and breast. But the birth of beauty goes back further still, to a time before Apollo and Dionysus, before human desire, when the world was mostly leaf and the first flower opened. Once upon a time, there were no flowers. 200 million years ago, to be only slightly more precise. There were plants then, of course, ferns and mosses, conifers and cicades, but these plants didn't form true flowers or fruit. Some of them reproduced asexually, cloning themselves by various means. Sexual reproduction was a relatively discreet affair, usually accomplished by releasing pollen onto the wind or water. By sheer chance, some of it would find its way to other members of the species, and a tiny, primitive seed would result. This pre-floriferous world was a slower, simpler, sleepier world than our own. Evolution proceeded more slowly, there being so much less sex, and what sex there was took place among close-by and closely related plants. Such a conservative approach to reproduction made for a biologically simpler world, since it generated relatively little novelty or variation. Life, on the whole, was more local and inbred. The world before flowers was sleepier than ours because, lacking fruit and large seeds, it couldn't support many warm-blooded creatures. Reptiles ruled, and life slowed to a crawl whenever it got cold. Little happened at night. It was a plainer-looking world, too, greener even than it is now, absent all the colors and patterns, not to mention scents, that flowers and fruits would bring into it. Beauty did not yet exist. That is, the way things looked had nothing to do with desire. Flowers changed everything. The angiosperms, as botanists call the plants that form flowers and then encased seeds, appeared during the Cretaceous period, and they spread over the earth with stunning rapidity. An abominable mystery is how Charles Darwin described this sudden and entirely inevitable event. Now, instead of relying on wind or water to move genes around, a plant could enlist the help of an animal by striking a grand coevolutionary compact: nutrition in exchange for transportation. With the advent of the flower, whole new levels of complexity come into the world. More interdependence, more information, more communication, more experimentation. The evolution of plants proceeded according to a new motive force: attraction between different species. Now, natural selection favored blooms that could rivet the attention of pollinators, fruits that appealed to foragers. The desires of other creatures became paramount in the evolution of plants, for the simple reason that the plants that succeeded at gratifying those desires wound up with more offspring. Beauty had emerged as a survival strategy. The new rules speeded the rate of evolutionary change. Bigger, brighter, sweeter, more fragrant, all these qualities were quickly rewarded under the new regime. But so was specialization. Since bestowing one's pollen on an insect that might deliver it to the wrong address, such as the blossoms of unrelated species, was wasteful, it became an advantage to look and smell as distinctive as possible, the better to command the undivided attention of a single, dedicated pollinator. Animal desire was thus parsed and subdivided, plants specialized accordingly, and an extraordinary flowering of diversity took place, much of it under the signs of coevolution and beauty. With flowers came fruit and seeds, and these too remade life on earth. By producing sugars and proteins to entice animals to disperse their seed, the angiosperms multiplied the world's supply of food energy, making possible the rise of large, warm-blooded mammals. Without flowers, the reptiles, which had gotten along fine in a leafy, fruitless world, would probably still rule. Without flowers, we would not be. So the flowers begot us, their greatest admirers. In time, human desire entered into the natural history of the flower, and the flower did what it has always done: made itself still more beautiful in the eyes of this animal, folding into its very being even the most improbable of our notions and tropes. Now came roses that resembled aroused nymphs, tulip petals in the shape of daggers, peonies bearing the scent of women. We in turn did our part, multiplying the flowers beyond reason, moving their seeds around the planet, writing books to spread their fame and ensure their happiness. For the flower, it was the same old story: another grand coevolutionary bargain with a willing, slightly credulous animal. A good deal on the whole, though not nearly as good as the earlier bargain with the bees. And what about us? How did we make out? We did very well by the flower. There were, of course, the pleasures to the senses, the sustenance of their fruit and seeds, and the vast store of new metaphor. But we gazed even farther into the blossom of a flower and found something more: the crucible of beauty, if not art, and maybe even a glimpse into the meaning of life. For look into a flower, and what do you see? Into the very heart of nature's double nature. That is, the contending energies of creation and dissolution, the spiring toward complex form and the tidal pull away from it. Apollo and Dionysus were names the Greeks gave to these two faces of nature, and nowhere in nature is their contest as plain or as poignant as it is in the beauty of a flower and its rapid passing. There, the achievement of order against all odds and its blithe abandonment. There, the perfection of art and the blind flux of nature. There, somehow, both transcendence and necessity. Could that be it? Right there, in a flower? The meaning of life? Chapter 3. Desire, intoxication. Plant, marijuana. Cannabis sativa, indica. The forbidden plant and its temptations are older than Eden, go back further even than we do. So too the promise, or threat, that forbidden plants have always made to the creature who would taste them. The promise, that is, of knowledge and the threat of mortality. If it sounds as if I'm speaking metaphorically about forbidden plants and knowledge, I don't mean to. In fact, I'm no longer so sure the author of Genesis was either. Living things have always had to make their way in a wild garden of flowers and vines, of leaves and trees and fungi that hold out not only nourishing things to eat, but deadly poisons too. Nothing is more important to a creature's survival than knowing which is which. Yet drawing a bright line through the middle of the garden, as the God of Genesis found, doesn't always work. The difficulty is that there are plants that do other, more curious things than simply sustain or extinguish life. Some heal. Others rouse or calm or quiet the body's pain. But most remarkable of all, there are plants in the garden that manufacture molecules with the power to change the subjective experience of reality we call consciousness. Why in the world should this be so? Why should evolution yield plants possessing such magic? What makes these plants so irresistible to us, and to many other creatures, when the cost of using them can be so high? Just what is the knowledge held out by a plant such as cannabis? And why is it forbidden? Start with the bright line, as all creatures must. How does one tell the dangerous plants from the ones that merely nourish? Taste is the first tip-off. Plants that don't wish to be eaten often manufacture bitter-tasting alkaloids. By the same token, plants that do wish to be eaten, like the apple, often manufacture a superabundance of sugars in the flesh around their seeds. So as a general rule, sweet is good, bitter, bad. Yet it turns out that it is some of the bitter, bad plants that contain the most powerful magic, that can answer our desire to alter the textures and even the contents of our consciousness. There it is, right in the middle of the word intoxication, hidden in plain sight. Toxic. The bright line between food and poison might hold, but not the one between poison and desire. The manifold and subtle dangers of the garden, to which a creature's sense of taste offers only the crudest map, are mainly the fruits of strategies plants have devised to defend themselves from animals. Most of the ingenuity of plants, that is, most of the work of a billion years of evolutionary trial and error, has been applied to learning, or rather inventing, the arts of biochemistry, at which plants excel beyond all human imagining. Even now, a large part of human knowledge about making medicines comes directly from plants. While we animals were busy nailing down things like locomotion and consciousness, the plants, without ever lifting a finger or giving it a thought, acquired an array of extraordinary and occasionally diabolical powers by discovering how to synthesize remarkably complicated molecules. The most remarkable of these molecules, at least from our perspective, are the ones designed expressly to act on the brains of animals, sometimes to attract their attention, as in the scent of a flower, but more often to repel and sometimes even destroy them. Some of these molecules are outright poisons designed simply to kill. But one of the great lessons of coevolution, a lesson recently learned by designers of pesticides and antibiotics, is that the all-out victory of one species over another is often pyrrhic. That's because a powerful, death-dealing toxin can exert such a strong selective pressure for resistance in its target population that it is quickly rendered ineffective. A better strategy may be to repel, disable, or confound. This fact might explain the astounding inventiveness of plant poisons, the vast catalog of chemical curiosities and horrors that first flowered in Cretaceous times with the rise of the angiosperms. The same evolutionary watershed, Darwin's abominable mystery that ushered in the dazzling arts of floral attraction, brought with it the darker arts of chemical warfare. Some plant toxins, such as nicotine, paralyze or convulse the muscles of pests who ingest them. Others, such as caffeine, unhinge an insect's nervous system and kill its appetite. Toxins in Datura and henbane and a great many other hallucinogens drive a plant's predators mad, stuffing their brains with visions distracting or horrible enough to take the creature's mind off lunch. Compounds called flavonoids change the taste of plant flesh on the tongues of certain animals, rendering the sweetest fruit sour or the sourest flesh sweet, depending on the plant's designs. Photosensitizers present in species such as the wild parsnip cause the animals that eat it to burn in the sun. Chromosomes exposed to these compounds spontaneously mutate when exposed to ultraviolet light. A molecule present in the sap of a certain tree prevents caterpillars that sample its leaves from ever growing into butterflies. By trial and error, animals figure out, sometimes over eons, sometimes over a single lifetime, which plants are safe to eat and which forbidden. Evolutionary counter-strategies arise too. Digestive processes that detoxify, feeding strategies that minimize the dangers, like that of the goat, which nibbles harmless quantities of a great many different plants, or heightened powers of observation and memory. This last strategy, at which humans particularly excel, allows one creature to learn from the mistakes and successes of another. The mistakes are, of course, especially instructive, as long as they're not your own, or if they are, they prove less than fatal. For even some of the toxins that kill in large doses turn out in smaller increments to do interesting things. Things that are interesting to animals as well as people. According to Ronald K. Siegel, a pharmacologist who has studied intoxication in animals, it is common for animals deliberately to experiment with plant toxins. When an intoxicant is found, the animal will return to the source repeatedly, sometimes with disastrous consequences. Cattle will develop a taste for loco weed that can prove fatal. Bighorn sheep will grind their teeth to useless nubs, scraping a hallucinogenic lichen off ledge rock. Siegel suggests that some of these adventurous animals served as our Virgils in the garden of psychoactive plants. Goats, who will try a little bit of anything, probably deserve credit for the discovery of coffee. Abyssinian herders in the 10th century observed that their animals would become particularly frisky after nibbling the shrub's bright red berries. Pigeons spacing out on cannabis seeds, a favorite food of many birds, may have tipped off the ancient Chinese, or Aryans or Scythians, to that plant's special properties. Peruvian legend has it that the puma discovered quinine. Indians observed that sick cats were often restored to health after eating the bark of the cinchona tree. Tucano Indians in the Amazon noticed that jaguars, not ordinarily herbivorous, would eat the bark of the yahe vine and hallucinate. The Indians who followed their lead say the yahe vine gives them jaguar eyes. Whenever I read something like this, I wonder, how do you tell when a jaguar is hallucinating? Then I think about Frank, my late, cranky old tomcat, who I became convinced used drug plants habitually in order to hallucinate. Every summer evening at around 5, Frank would lumber into the vegetable garden for a happy hour nip of Nepeta cataria, or catnip. He would first sniff, then tug at the leaves with his teeth, and proceed to roll around in paroxysms of what looked to me like sexual ecstasy. His pupils would shrink to pinpricks and take on a slightly scary thousand-mile stare, preparatory to pouncing on unseen enemies or, who can say, lovers. Frank would crash land in the dirt, pick himself up, do a funny little sidestep, then pounce again until, exhausted, he'd go sleep it off in the shade of a tomato plant. I learned later that catnip contains a chemical compound called nepetalactone, which mimics the pheromone cats produce in their urine during courtship. This chemical key just happens to fit an aphrodisiac lock in a cat's brain and apparently no other. It was amusing to watch a plant derange my cat, but also unsettling. For that brief interlude, Frank would wobble through the garden as though he were literally beside himself. Yet, he'd be back again the next day. Though, curiously, never before 5. Maybe he ritualized the practice to keep it under control. Or maybe it took him the better part of the day to remember just where it was that the magic plant grew. I'd planted the catnip strictly for Frank's pleasure, though looking back I sometimes wonder if the plant wasn't also in my garden as a substitute, or placeholder, for the forbidden plant I sometimes wished I could grow for myself. Cannabis, I mean. At once an intoxicant, a medicine, and a fiber, this last use admittedly of absolutely no interest to me, cannabis is one of the most powerful of the plants that will grow around here. It is also, as I write, the most dangerous plant I could grow in my garden. Frank's happy hour ritual was a daily reminder that my garden was capable of producing much more than food or beauty, that it also could perform some rather remarkable feats of brain chemistry, and by doing so answer other, more complicated desires. I sometimes think we've allowed our gardens to be Baudelaireized, that the full range of their powers and possibilities has been sacrificed to a cult of plant prettiness that obscures more dubious truths about nature, our own included. It hasn't always been this way, and we may someday come to regard the contemporary garden of vegetables and flowers as a place almost Victorian in its repressions and elisions. For most of their history, after all, gardens have been more concerned with the power of plants than with their beauty. With the power, that is, to change us in various ways, for good and for ill. In ancient times, people all over the world grew or gathered sacred plants and fungi with the power to inspire visions or conduct them on journeys to other worlds. Some of these people, who are sometimes called shamans, returned with the kind of spiritual knowledge that underwrites whole religions. The medieval apothecary garden cared little for aesthetics, focusing instead on species that healed and intoxicated, and occasionally poisoned. Witches and sorcerers cultivated plants with the power to cast spells. In our vocabulary, psychoactive plants. Their potion recipes called for such things as datura, opium poppies, belladonna, hashish, fly agaric mushrooms, Amanita muscaria, and the skins of toads, which can contain DMT, a powerful hallucinogen. These ingredients would be combined in a hemp seed oil-based flying ointment that the witches would then administer vaginally using a special dildo. This was the broomstick by which these women were said to travel. The medieval gardens of witches and alchemists were forcibly uprooted and forgotten, or at least euphemized beyond recognition, but even the comparatively benign ornamental gardens that came after them went out of their way to honor the darker, more mysterious face of nature. The Gothic gardens of England and Italy, for example, always made room for intimations of mortality, by including a dead tree, say, or a melancholy grotto, and the occasional frisson of horror. These gardens were interested in changing people's consciousness, too, though more in the way a horror movie does than a drug. It's only been in modern times, after industrial civilization concluded, somewhat prematurely, that nature's powers were no longer any match for its own, that our gardens became benign, sunny, and environmentally correct places from which the old horticultural dangers and temptations were expelled. Or if not expelled, almost willfully forgotten. For even in grandmother's garden, you're apt to find datura and morning glories, the seeds of which some Indians consume as a sacramental hallucinogen, and opium poppies. Right there, the makings of a witch's flying ointment or apothecary's tonic. The knowledge that once attended these powerful plants, however, has all but vanished. And as soon as this plant knowledge is restored to consciousness, As soon as, say, one forms the intention of slitting the head of an opium poppy to release its narcotic sap, so too must be its taboo. Curiously, growing Papaver somniferum in America is legal. Unless, that is, it is done in the knowledge that you are growing a drug, when, rather magically, the exact same physical act becomes the felony of manufacturing a controlled substance. Evidently, the Old Testament and the criminal code both make a connection between forbidden plants and knowledge. I once grew opium poppies in my garden. Yes, with felonious intent. I also grew marijuana, back when that was no big deal. I still grow grapes and hops, both of which can be made into legal intoxicants, as long as I don't sell them. And in my herb garden, St. John's wort, an antidepressant, chamomile, and valerian, both mild sedatives. I should probably explain my interest in these plants. At least in the beginning, this had less to do with my interest in using drugs, which was never more than mild, than with an impulse I think most gardeners share. In fact, by the time I planted a few cannabis seeds in the early 1980s, I no longer smoked at all. Pot, fairly reliably, rendered me paranoid and stupid. But I had just taken up gardening and was avid to try anything. The magic of a bourbon rose or a beefsteak tomato seemed very much of a piece with the magic of a psychoactive plant. I still feel this way. So when my sister's boyfriend asked if I might want to plant a few seeds he'd picked out of some really amazing Maui, I decided to give it a try. As much as anything, just to see if I could grow it. To another gardener, this will not seem odd, for we gardeners are like that, eager to try the improbable, if only to harvest a good story, to see if we can't grow an artichoke in Zone 5 or brew homemade echinacea tea from the roots of our purple coneflowers. Deep down, I suspect that many gardeners regard themselves as small-time alchemists, transforming the dross of compost and water and sunlight into substances of rare value and beauty and power. Maybe at some level we're still in touch with the power of the old gardens. Also, one of the attractions of gardening is the independence it can confer. From the greengrocer, the florist, the pharmacist, and for some, the drug dealer. One does not have to go all the way back to the land to experience the satisfaction of providing for yourself off the grid of the national economy. So, yes, I was curious to see if I could grow some really amazing Maui in my Connecticut garden. It seemed to me this would indeed represent a particularly impressive sort of alchemy. But as things turned out, my experiment in growing marijuana was of a piece with my experience smoking it. Paranoid and stupid being the operative terms. It was in the spring of 1982, I believe, that I sprouted a handful of the Maui seeds on a moistened paper towel. Within days, two of them had germinated. As soon as the weather warmed, I planted the seedlings outdoors, not in the garden proper, but behind the falling-down barn back behind the house, in a mound of ancient cow manure I had inherited from the dairy farmer whose place this used to be. I more or less forgot about the plants until a few months later, when I returned to find what looked like a pair of Christmas trees, 8 feet tall at least, rising over the late summer weeds. Lush, leafy, emerald green shrubs growing avidly in the thinning September light. No one would ever claim marijuana is a great beauty, though a gardener can't help but admire the sheer green exuberance of this plant, a towering heap of leafy palms held up to the sun in an ecstatic frenzy of photosynthesis. The plant has the ardor of a weed. Though frost was just around the corner, I've lost tomatoes here as early as September 15th, the big plants gave no sign that they were even thinking of flowering. This I regarded as disappointing but hardly tragic, since in those days people still smoked cannabis leaves. Nowadays, of course, only the unpollinated female flowers, called sensimilla, are deemed worthwhile. Growers simply throw the leaves and stems onto the compost pile. Even so, I decided to hold off for a few more weeks to see if I couldn't harvest a few buds. The plants continued to grow at an alarming rate, adding as much as a foot to their height and girth every week, so that by the end of September, they'd made themselves conspicuous from just about any point on the property. There they were, a couple of jolly green giants lurking behind the barn, and I found myself in a state of almost perpetual anxiety and dread. I'd read in the papers that the state police sometimes did aerial reconnaissance to locate marijuana gardens, and any time I heard the drone of a small plane overhead, I raced outside to see if its flight path would take it over my plants. The slowing down of any full-size American sedan on my road was enough to rattle me. Every day that fall, I weighed the risks of detection and a killing frost against the potential reward of a few buds. A close call ended my career as a marijuana farmer. I'd ordered a cord of wood from a man who'd posted a flyer in town. He showed up with the first half early on a Saturday morning, a compact block of a man with a pewter crew cut, and asked where I wanted it stacked. Though open to the elements on two sides, the ruined barn did at least have a tight roof, and we agreed it was far and away the best place to stack the wood. But before getting down to work, the man and I fell into conversation, leaning there on the warm hood of his truck, enjoying the crisp October morning. Making small talk, I asked if he sold cordwood for a living. No, he chuckled. Firewood was just a sideline. That and plowing driveways in the winter. 9 to 5, I'm chief of police of New Milford. All at once, the bones in my legs began to go soft. I found I could no longer form a sentence without specifically addressing the muscles in my lips. The barn, you see, was nothing more than a shell of boards, and no police officer standing in it could fail to spot the two green giants through the opening in the rear wall. But what else was I going to do? Dumping the wood anywhere but in the barn was ridiculous. Unfortunately, no non-ridiculous stratagem presented itself to my stupefied brain. I simply blurted out that, on second thought, I wanted the whole load dumped right here in the middle of the driveway. That'd be just fine, thanks. Don't be silly, the police chief said, turning to climb back into the truck's cab. It's no trouble at all. I'll just back the load up to the barn. No. I can only imagine how I must have sounded. Right here. Here is perfect. Near the house. Burn it right away. Okay, maybe some of it, but not the whole cord. The truck's engine roared to life. Yes, the whole cord. Here. I may have been shouting now. This is exactly where I want it. And before he could throw his transmission into reverse, I jumped up onto the rear fender and started furiously to throw logs over my shoulder, onto the driveway and the lawn behind the truck, anywhere to block its path to the barn. The man got out, squinted at me in bewilderment, and then finally, blessedly, shrugged his shoulders. The words, "suit yourself," have never sounded so sweet. As soon as the wood was unloaded, the chief of police drove off to go get the second half of my cord, and I, temporarily reprieved but still in full panic, ransacked the tool shed in search of an axe. There would be no buds after all. I chopped down the two plants, the trunks of which were as thick around as my forearms, hacked off the branches, and stuffed the fragrant mass of foliage into a pair of heavy-duty trash bags, which I hauled up to a crawl space in the attic, all in about 4 minutes. My harvest, when dried, yielded a couple of pounds of leaves that smelled like old socks. Something happened when you smoked them, but the effect had less in common with a high than with a sinus headache. As you can probably guess, I've told my marijuana growing story more than a few times. After dinner with friends, say, and I can usually count on a few laughs. The happy ending is one reason, but the other reason the story qualifies as light comedy is that the suspense on which it hinges, while real enough, is not exactly a matter of life or death. If the police chief had spotted my plants, things would have gotten uncomfortable for me, but it was not as if I would have gone to jail. In 1982, a legal slap on the wrist, and perhaps a certain amount of personal embarrassment, what do I tell my parents? My boss, was really about all a small-time marijuana grower had to fear. It hadn't been many years before this misadventure, after all, that an American president, Jimmy Carter, had proposed that marijuana be decriminalized. His sons and even his drug czar smoked. And Bob Hope was telling benign jokes about doobies in primetime. Marijuana then was harmless, funny, and it seemed to everyone, on the verge of social acceptance. In the years since, there has been a sea change concerning cannabis in America. By the end of the decade, the plant had suddenly acquired or been endowed with extraordinary new powers, which, among other things, rendered my story a period piece, quaint in its goofiness and not at all likely to be repeated. A couple of facts will illustrate the change. The minimum penalty for the cultivation of a kilogram of marijuana, the size of my harvest, more or less, in this state has, since 1988, been a mandatory 5-year jail sentence. Other states are harsher still. Growing any amount of marijuana in Oklahoma qualifies a gardener for a life sentence. Jail time would not be my only worry were I so foolish as to reprise my experiment. If the New Milford police chief happened to find marijuana growing in my garden today, he would have the power to seize my house and land, regardless of whether I was ultimately convicted of a crime. That's because, according to the somewhat magical reasoning of the federal asset forfeiture laws, my garden can be found guilty of violating the drug laws, even if I am not. The titles of proceedings brought under these laws sound rather less like exercises in American jurisprudence than medieval animism. United States versus 1974 Cadillac Eldorado sedan. If the police chief chose to bring such an action, the people of Connecticut versus Michael Pollan's garden, he'd simply have to prove that my land had been used in the commission of a crime for it to become the property of the New Milford Police Department, theirs to dispose of as they wished. So do things stand in America today that yielding to the temptation of a forbidden plant not only can get you temporarily expelled from your garden, but can get your garden taken away forever. The swiftness of this change in the weather, the demonizing of a plant that less than 20 years ago was on the cusp of general acceptance, will surely puzzle historians of the future. They will wonder why it was that the drug war of the 80s, 90s, and 2000s fought the vast majority of its battles over marijuana. They will wonder why, during this period, Americans jailed more of their citizens than any other country in history, and why one of every three of those were in prison because of their involvement with drugs, nearly 50,000 of them solely for crimes involving marijuana. And they will wonder why Americans would have been willing to give up so many of their hard-won liberties in the fight against this plant. For in the last years of the 20th century, a series of Supreme Court cases and government actions specifically involving marijuana led to a substantial increase in the power of the government at the expense of the Bill of Rights. As a result of the war against cannabis, Americans are demonstrably less free today. More drug arrests are for crimes involving marijuana than any other drug. Nearly 700,000 in 1998, 88% of them for possession. Marijuana cases account for most of the asset forfeitures that law enforcement budgets have come to rely on. Marijuana is the primary focus of drug prevention efforts in the schools, drug testing in the workplace, and public service advertising about drugs. What a dissenting Supreme Court justice in 1988 deplored as a new drug exception to the Constitution has been substantially based on marijuana cases. For example, in Illinois versus Gates, 1983, the Supreme Court carved broad new exceptions to the Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable searches, as well as the Sixth Amendment right to confront one's accusers. The venerable principle of posse comitatus, which holds that the armed forces of the United States cannot be used to police U.S. territory, has been suspended during the war against marijuana, notably by President Reagan, who deployed troops to rout out growers in Northern California. The First Amendment has suffered as well. Magazines aimed at pot growers have been harassed and, in one case, Sensimilla Tips, raided and closed down. In 1998, the federal government threatened to revoke the license of California doctors who exercised their First Amendment right to talk to patients about the medical benefits of marijuana. Also that year, Congress ordered the District of Columbia not to count the votes of its citizens in a referendum on medical marijuana. Arguably, the war against cannabis has also eroded the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, since drastic mandatory minimum sentences forced most marijuana defendants to accept plea bargains, as well as the presumption of innocence, since asset forfeiture allows the government to seize assets without proving guilt. Historians of the future will decide for themselves exactly why marijuana, of all drugs, should have become the focus of the American drug war, why the bright line of prohibition was drawn around this particular plant rather than coca or poppies. Did marijuana pose a grave threat to public health? Or was marijuana the only illicit drug in wide enough use to justify waging so ambitious a war in the first place? Remove the 20 million or so Americans who use marijuana, and we are left with a drug abuse epidemic involving roughly 2 million regular heroin and cocaine users. A public health problem, to be sure, but serious enough to justify spending $20 billion a year, or modifying the Bill of Rights? Whatever the case, it's hard to believe such a powerful new taboo against marijuana would have stuck if the plant hadn't already been a powerful symbol. Certainly, marijuana's close identification with the counterculture made it an attractive target to a drug war that, whatever else it may have been, was part of a political and cultural reaction against the 60s. But whatever the reason, by the end of the 20th century, this plant and its taboo had appreciably changed American life, not once, but twice. The first time rather mildly, with marijuana's widespread popularity beginning in the 60s, and then again, perhaps more profoundly, in its role as casus belli in the war against drugs. There has been another dramatic change in the story of marijuana since my brief career as a grower, and that is the change in the plant itself. When the natural history of cannabis is written, the American drug war will loom as one of its most important chapters, on a par with the introduction of cannabis to the Americas by African slaves, say, or the ancient Scythians' discovery that hemp could be smoked. The practice of smoking as we know it wouldn't come to Europe until Columbus brought it back from America, but the Scythians invented something like it around 700 BC. According to Herodotus, they would put their heads into small tents designed to trap the fumes from cannabis buds placed on red-hot rocks, until they rise up to dance and betake themselves to singing. For the modern prohibition against marijuana led directly to a revolution in both the genetics and the culture of the plant. It stands as one of the richer ironies of the drug war that the creation of a powerful new taboo against marijuana led directly to the creation of a powerful new plant. Marijuana's recent natural history is much harder to reconstruct than its social history, since so much of it took place underground and in secret. This plant's Johnny Appleseeds have tended to be far-flung and anonymous. But I was inspired to go looking for them a few years ago, after I learned, from a friend of a friend, just how sophisticated marijuana cultivation had become in the years since my feeble attempt, and how much more potent American pot had grown. This fellow had once helped design and install a series of state-of-the-art grow rooms. As I listened to him talk about his work one evening, dilating on the relative benefits of sodium and metal halide lights, the optimal number of clones to plant per kilowatt, and the intricacies of hybridizing indicas and sativas, it dawned on me that this was what the best gardeners of my generation had been doing all these years. They had been underground, perfecting cannabis. To a marijuana grower, Amsterdam in the 1990s was something like what Paris in the 1920s was to a writer, a place where alienated expatriates could go to practice their craft in peace and hook up with a community of kindred souls. Growing marijuana is not precisely legal in Holland, but several hundred coffee shops are licensed to sell it, and small-scale growing to supply those shops is officially tolerated. Beginning in the late 1980s, as the United States escalated its campaign against marijuana, American refugees from the drug war began moving to Amsterdam. Growers took with them their seeds and expertise, and this migration, matched with a Dutch genius for horticulture going back to the tulip craze, made Amsterdam once again the place to go if you cared deeply about one particular plant. I went to Amsterdam to learn about the recent history of marijuana in America and to see, okay, and sample, what these gardeners had wrought in the years since my hasty retirement. I arrived in late November at the time of the Cannabis Cup, an annual convention and harvest fair, sponsored by High Times magazine, that attracts many of the brighter lights in the field. American growers come to the cup to do what gardeners always do when they gather in the off-season, swap seeds and stories and new techniques and show off their prize specimens. Some of the pioneers of modern marijuana growing were on hand, and I found that if I approached them as a fellow gardener, they were more than happy to share their experiences and knowledge. Within a few days, I had begun to piece together the story of how American gardeners, operating in the shadow of a ferocious drug war without benefit of professional training, had managed to transform homegrown, a derisive 1970s term for third-rate domestic marijuana, into what is today the most prized and expensive flower in the world. Top-quality Sensimilla sells for upward of $500 an ounce, making cannabis America's leading cash crop. But while the ingenuity and resourcefulness of growers had much to do with this success story, so did the ingenuity and resourcefulness of the plant itself. From the plant's perspective, the American drug war presented an opportunity to expand its range into North America, where it had never had much of a presence. Except, that is, as hemp, a distinct, non-psychoactive form of cannabis widely grown for its fibers before prohibition. To succeed in North America, cannabis had to do two things. It had to prove it could gratify a human desire so brilliantly that people would take extraordinary risks to cultivate it, and it had to find the right combination of genes to adapt to a most peculiar and thoroughly artificial new environment. This is the story of how that happened. Most of the marijuana smoked in America was grown in Mexico until the mid-1970s, when the Mexican government, at the behest of the United States, began spraying the crop with the herbicide Paraquat. About the same time, the U.S. government began cracking down on pot smugglers. With foreign supplies contracting and the safety of Mexican marijuana in doubt, a large market for domestically grown marijuana suddenly opened up. In a sense, the rapid emergence of a domestic marijuana industry represents a triumph of protectionism. In the beginning, domestic marijuana was grossly inferior to the imported product. Part of the problem was that most early growers did what I did: plant seeds picked out of pot that had been grown in tropical places. Invariably, these were the seeds of Cannabis sativa, an equatorial species poorly adapted to life in the northern latitudes. Sativa can't withstand frost and, as I discovered, usually won't set flowers north of the 30th parallel. Working with such seeds, growers found it difficult to produce a high-quality domestic crop, and especially Sensimilla, outside places such as California and Hawaii. The search was on for a type of marijuana that would flourish and flower farther north, and by the end of the decade, it had been found. American hippies traveling the hashish trail through Afghanistan returned with seeds of Cannabis indica, a stout, frost-tolerant species that had been grown for centuries by hashish producers in the mountains of Central Asia. The species looks quite unlike the familiar marijuana plant, a distinct advantage to its early growers. It rarely grows taller than 4 or 5 feet, as compared to 15 for the stateliest sativas, and its purplish-green leaves are shorter and rounder than the long, slender fingers of sativa. Indica also proved to be exceptionally potent, although many people will tell you that its smoke is harsher and its high more physically debilitating than that of sativa. Even so, the introduction of indica to America proved a boon, since it allowed growers in all 50 states to cultivate Sensimilla for the first time. Some indicas will flower reliably as far north as Alaska. Initially, indicas were grown by themselves. But enterprising growers soon discovered that by crossing the new species with Cannabis sativa, it was possible to produce vigorous hybrids that would combine the most desirable traits of each plant while downplaying its worst. The smoother taste and clear, bell-like high associated with the best equatorial sativas, for example, could be combined with the superior potency and hardiness of an indica. The result was what Robert Connell Clark, a marijuana botanist I met in Amsterdam, calls the Great Revolution in Cannabis Genetics. Marijuana's genetic revolution recalls an earlier horticultural watershed, the introduction of the China Rose to Europe in 1789, an event that made it possible for the first time to breed roses that would flower more than once a season. This ultimately led to the development of the ever-blooming hybrid tea rose. For both the rose and marijuana, human mobility coupled with human desire, for a rose that would rebloom in August, for sensimilla that would grow in the north, led to the reunification of two distinct evolutionary lines of a plant that had diverged thousands of years before. In both cases, the introduction of a set of plant genes found halfway around the world created undreamed of new possibilities. In a wave of innovative breeding performed around 1980, most of it by amateurs working in California and the Pacific Northwest, the modern American marijuana plant was born. Even today, the sativa-indica hybrids developed during this period, including Northern Lights, Skunk No. 1, Big Bud, and California Orange, are regarded as the benchmarks of modern marijuana breeding. They remain the principal genetic lines with which most subsequent breeders have worked. Nowadays, American cannabis genetics are widely regarded as the world's best. They are the basis of the thriving cannabis seed trade in Holland, as the American growers I met there were quick to point out. Yet without the Dutch to safeguard and disseminate these strains, the important genetic work done by American breeders would probably have been lost by now, scattered to the winds by the drug war. Until the early 1980s, almost all the marijuana grown in America was grown outdoors, in the hills of California's Humboldt County, in the cornfields of the Farm Belt, cannabis and corn thrive under similar conditions, in backyards just about everywhere, and a lot more of it than anybody realized. In 1982, the Reagan administration was chagrined to discover that the amount of domestic marijuana being seized was actually a third higher than its official estimate of the total American crop. Shortly thereafter, the administration launched an ambitious nationwide program, enlisting local law enforcement agencies and, for the first time, the armed forces to crush the domestic marijuana industry. Though the government's campaign failed to eradicate marijuana farming, it did change the rules of the game, forcing both the plant and its growers to adapt. "The government pushed us all indoors," a grower from Indiana told me. And it was there, under the blazing metal halide lights, that cannabis sativa indica attained a kind of perfection. The early indoor gardeners had basically sought to bring outdoor conditions and practices inside, growing full-size plants in soil under a regimen of light and nutrients designed more or less to mimic those found in nature. Very soon, however, growers discovered that nature was, if anything, holding back this particular plant, retarding its full potential. By judiciously manipulating the five main environmental factors under their control, water, nutrients, light, carbon dioxide levels, and heat, as well as the genetics of the plant, growers found that the marijuana plant, this remarkably obliging weed, could be made to perform wonders. Most of the hybridizing needed to adapt cannabis to indoor conditions was done in the early 1980s by amateurs working in the Pacific Northwest. Cultivars with a high proportion of indica genes performed especially well indoors, it was found, and these were further bred and selected for small stature, high yield, early flowering, and increased potency. No one knew just what this plant was capable of, but by the end of the decade, there were sativa-indica hybrids yielding flowers big as fists on dwarf plants no higher than your knee. During this period, cannabis genetics improved to the point where it was no longer unusual to find sensimilla with concentrations of THC, marijuana's principal psychoactive compound, as high as 15%. Before the crackdown on marijuana growers, THC levels in ordinary marijuana ranged from 2 to 3%, according to the DEA. For sensimilla, 5 to 8%. Nowadays, THC levels upward of 20% are not unheard of. The plant had adapted more brilliantly to its strange new environment than anyone could have expected. For cannabis, the drug war is what global warming will be for much of the rest of the plant world, a cataclysm that some species will turn into a great opportunity to expand their range. Cannabis has thrived on its taboo the way another plant might thrive in a particularly acid soil. Along with the progress in genetics came rapid advances in technique. Indoors, as one grower put it, the gardener is Mother Nature, but even better. Growth rates and yields made large strides through the 1980s as growers discovered they could speed photosynthesis by supplying plants with all the nutrients, carbon dioxide, and light they could handle. Vast amounts, as it turned out. Cannabis is, after all, a weed. Gardeners found that their plants could absorb hundreds of thousands of lumens, a blinding amount of light, 24 hours a day. Later on, by abruptly slashing their diet of light to 12 hours daily, and changing from metal halide to sodium lights, the frequency of which more closely mimics the autumn sun, growers could shock their plants into flowering before they were 8 weeks old. With the right equipment, an indoor grower could create a utopia for his plants, an artificial habitat more perfect than any in nature, and his happy, happy weeds would respond. These sedulous attentions would be wasted on male plants, which are worse than useless in sensimilla production. As long as a female marijuana plant remains unpollinated, it will continue to produce new calyxes, steadily adding to the length of its flower. In this state of perpetual sexual frustration, the plant also continues to produce large quantities of THC-rich resins. But allow even a few grains of pollen to reach the plant's flowers, and the process abruptly stops. Bud and resin production shuts down, the plant commences producing seeds, and the sensimilla is ruined. Growers who start their plants from seed rogue out the males as soon as they declare their gender, but since this doesn't happen until the plants mature, much time and space are wasted growing males. The solution was to plant clones instead of seeds, cuttings taken from established female mother plants. From the perspective of these fortunate females, the practice is an evolutionary boon. They get to multiply their genes without diluting them, as would be the case in sexual reproduction. Whether cloning is such a boon for the species as a whole is, as the story of the apple suggests, much less certain. Because these clones were genetically identical, the plants were guaranteed to be female. They also turned out to be biologically mature from the start, which meant that even a 6 or 8 inch plant could now be forced to flower. By 1987, all these various advances and techniques had coalesced into a state-of-the-art indoor growing regimen that came to be known as the Sea of Green. Dozens of closely spaced and genetically identical plants grown from clones under high-intensity light. A sea of green garden consisting of 100 clones, grown under a pair of 1,000-watt lights in a space no bigger than a pool table, will yield 3 pounds of sensimilla in 2 months' time. Before I left Amsterdam, I wanted to visit a modern marijuana garden, and on my last night, an expatriate American grower I'd befriended agreed to show me his. For days I'd been fishing for an invitation, and I could see he was torn between the outlaw's professional discretion and the gardener's irrepressible desire to show off. In the end, the gardener prevailed. The garden was in a working-class suburb half an hour north of Amsterdam, and on the train the grower told me he'd chosen this particular town because it is home to a candy factory, a bakery, and a chemical plant. Marijuana plants, and indicas in particular, emit a strong, acrid odor. He was counting on the cacophony of smells produced by these three neighbors to cover the telltale stink of his plants. When we came to the gardener's house, he showed me upstairs. At the far end of a dark, narrow,